We want to begin with prayer.
Our Father, we thank Thee for the work which Thou hast done for us in Jesus Christ our Lord, and for giving us a perspective on the needs of the unbeliever, that he needs Thy gospel even as we needed it. And we pray that in this final session we may be led in another way to become all things to all men, that by all means men may be saved. We ask, O God, that we may keep the concerns of the unbeliever foremost in our minds, that we may not slip into a concern for ourselves that removes us from presenting the gospel as we ought to the people of our day. We ask, Heavenly Father, that Thou wouldst help us to give a reason for the hope that is within us, and that these reasons may be sound, that they may be in accord with Thy holy word, and that through the apologetic task we may present more effectively Thy word to the people of our day. These things we pray in Thy Son, on whom the gospel and the scriptures center. Amen. Now, the notion of an apologetic for the tender-minded seems, on the surface, to be a very strange notion. Isn't apologetics essentially for the tough-minded? Doesn't apologetics consist of presenting hard reasons in behalf of the Christian faith to those who have hard intellectual objections? The normal way of thinking of apologetics is that it deals with that kind of person, with the tough-minded kind of person, and that the tender-minded is really not within the purview of the apologist. The tender-minded person, it's generally thought, is to be preached to, not argued with. We distinguish between tough and tender-minded along the following lines. The tough-minded person is concerned with truth. He's concerned with the truth question. He wants to get a philosophy of life that is, as a matter of fact, true. The tender-minded person focuses his attention not so much on the truth question, but on satisfaction. What he's looking for is a philosophy of life that will feel right, that will satisfy his personal needs. That distinction between tough and tender-minded comes, of course, from William James, from the Varieties of Religious Experience, and it was picked up by Herbert Feigl in a statement which I have at the beginning of my book, Christianity for the Tough-Minded. I'm very much convinced that there is an apologetic for the tender-minded, and that we need, particularly in our generation, to know what that is. Because in our day, there are many people who have attempted to dump a tough-minded approach to the world. They have done this in reaction to modern science and technology. They have reacted from intellectual pursuits and concerns and have moved into an area where feeling counts more than thinking. Why has this occurred? Well, you already know. In the sessions that we've had already, we've emphasized how, in Luther's phrase, the drunken man staggers from one wall to the other. The natural man knocks himself senseless against one wall, staggers across, and knocks himself senseless against the other wall. And we've seen how, in the 19th century, there was a tremendous emphasis on science and technology as potentially solving man's problems. Then came the wars of our own time, and people reacted against this. The pendulum swung from confidence in rationality as a means of solving our problems all the way over to a kind of gut-level existentialism in which no one particularly feels that he can get absolute or final answers, but everyone's answers are limited to his own existential situation, to the confines of his own existence. Here in California, particularly, you are aware of this sort of thing because it is here that people wander cloudy from Berkeley to Carmel, to use Simon and Garfunkel's famous phrase. There is a cloudiness of mind where the concern is with feeling and experience. The Haight-Ashbury phenomenon is certainly at the very center of that sort of thing. The notion that science and technology have betrayed us. Science and technology are part of the bourgeois establishment. And the only answer to this is to stop the world and get off. In other words, to dump that lifestyle, that perspective, and move out into a different kind of life, which centers on feeling. In connection with this, of course, there is a heightened interest in the Eastern religions. And the Eastern religions, as we've emphasized already, stress not any objective means of testing, but inner experience. We emphasize that if you get into a discussion with a Buddhist, for example, the Buddhist is not concerned with any external objective proofs of Buddhism. His suggestion to you is to enter into Buddhism, to experience it, and you will find satisfaction there. So many Christians faced with this sort of phenomenon are helpless because they have gotten into the habit of not offering any kind of apologetic, and they themselves have presented only a subjective feeling kind of response to people's interest in religion. And they find themselves, therefore, saying exactly the same thing that other religions do. Just as the Buddhist says, try the Eightfold Path, so the Christian says, try Jesus. I've found satisfaction. You see the difficulty with this. The person who is looking for satisfaction and who hears a number of people all saying that their particular approach provides it is stymied. What exactly is he going to do in a situation like that? Is he going to try to experience all these different religions? My goodness, life isn't long enough to manage that. I don't know if I mentioned previously Ogden Nash's magnificent little poem, The Seven Spiritual Ages of Mrs. Marmaduke Moore. But this poem is a pretty good representation of the problem if one tries religious options in that fashion. Mrs. Marmaduke Moore, every 10 years, leaps into another religion. She experiences another religious situation. And one of the lines in it is, with a whoop and a holler, she leapt into the land of the sweet Baha'i. people who try to handle their religious problems that way simply don't get anywhere, because the minute you commit yourself to something, it has such an impact upon you that it will take a long, long time, generally, for you to extricate yourself from it if it doesn't prove to be adequate. Read Arthur Koestler. Arthur Koestler, who tried Marxism, and it took him 10 years to get out of this after he had involved himself in it. Then he went from there to the East, thinking that perhaps Eastern wisdom would do the trick. And from that we have his book, The Lotus and the Robot. Fascinating book. He went to the founts of Eastern wisdom. The only difficulty was that he didn't find any wisdom. And the account is, in some ways, a kind of hilarious travelogue of what occurs when you visit gurus and mystics. In one instance, he went up the mountain with much difficulty to find a particularly attractive guru, and he spent a half an hour with the guru, and the guru said not one single word in the course of the half hour. Koestler told him all of his difficulties, and the guru assiduously picked his toenails during the entire session. And this was, needless to say, a frustrating experience for Koestler. The point is that you can't just keep jumping from one thing to another. Life isn't long enough to cover all the options. And what do you do exactly? Do you alphabetize the religious possibilities and try them in alphabetical order? My goodness, by the time you've gone through six or seven of these, you'll be so jaded psychologically that you wouldn't know religious truth if it had a sign on it. But that's exactly the difficulty the evangelical encounters when he tries to deal with the tender-minded person. It seems on the surface as if the only thing he can do in such situations is to provide a testimony and a suggestion to try it, and yet that brings Christianity down to the same level as the other religions of the world that offer no objective evidence. How could such a problem be dealt with? It looks as if objective evidence is just what won't have any influence on the tender-minded person, because he's moved away from objectivity, science, rationality, and that sort of thing. Yet, on the other hand, If you don't use anything that provides objective reference, how can you possibly be in any different position from the other religions of the world that are saying, try it, you'll like it? It looks like an impossible dilemma. I don't think it is. I think there is a way past this, and I want to talk about the problem on two levels, really, by dividing the tender-minded category into two subcategories. Now, of course, these are extreme categories. That is to say, I am describing a limiting case in both instances. You will not find people falling directly and simply into either one of these subcategories of tender-minded. But it's usually best, when you're trying to get something across, to present it in its most clean-cut form so that the blendings will be more understandable later. We will distinguish between the lower level and the upper level tender-minded. By the lower level tender-minded, I mean the people who even have trouble focusing their attention sufficiently to memorize the words of a Simon and Garfunkel song. I mean the person who has really opted out, who has extreme difficulty in focusing on what you're saying, to the point where it's hard for him to focus on any particular issue. Here, of course, caricaturing one end of the tender-minded spectrum. The person who has entirely stepped out of the society and who finds it difficult to speak in more than monosyllabic terms on any subject and who is really not interested in very much. The general response of such a person is sort of, who needs it? It sort of boils down to that. The person who gives you the impression that he considers you to be a representative of the whole bourgeois, technological, scientific situation, perhaps even a member of the military-industrial complex, and therefore not really worth dealing with in matters like this. What's worse, he considers you to be naturally religious. In other words, you need religion, whereas he doesn't. That's your bag, but it isn't my bag. And the discussion goes on sort of that level. Now remember, this is an extreme case. You will hardly ever meet anyone exactly like the person I've described, but it'll give you an idea of continuum, the gamut that exists within the tender-minded category. Now, what do you do with this kind of person? This kind of person is saying, in essence, that he doesn't need to consider the case for Christianity at all, because religion is a matter of aesthetics. Religion is a matter of aesthetics. That is, some people are moved that way, and other people are not moved that way, and if you don't happen to be moved that way, you don't need to bother with it. Now, my strong suggestion with people at this point is to use, in a slightly different form, the fundamental technique that we talked about at the beginning of these sessions, namely showing him that what he has to do to survive in ordinary life, when applied to the religious question, will vindicate Christianity. The modification is this, that what he has to do in ordinary life requires him to make decisions, and these decisions are life decisions. And he therefore cannot get out of making a religious decision simply because he thinks that that is superfluous. The existentialists have emphasized that nobody gets out of making decisions. Everybody has to make decisions. Even the person who puts things off and who will not face issues is actually making as many decisions as the person who realizes that he's doing so. The guy who decides not to make a decision has, of course, made one. He has made a decision not to make a decision, and that is also a decision. We need to help this person to see that even though he has opted out of bourgeois society, he has not opted out of decision-making, nor has he opted out of life decision-making. Every time he jumps on his Suzuki, he is making a decision. And the decision is based on probability evidence that the thing won't blow up, for example. Every time he crosses the street, he does it in the very same way as any bourgeois person does. He looks both ways in order to be sure that he won't be flattened, because the person in this category is as equally able to be flattened as the most bourgeois fellow that he can think of. In other words, the person who says, "I don't care about objectivity, I don't care about knowledge, I don't care about facts, it's the way I look at the world," that person still looks both ways before he crosses the street. He does not expect that the world out there in the realm of traffic is somehow determined by his own bag or his own perspective. He fully recognizes that the stuff coming along there in the street has an objectivity that has no bearing whatever on his own personal interests. And the clear evidence of this is that he doesn't just whirl around and dash out into the street in a mystical stupor. Or if he does, then he doesn't have a chance to do anything else subsequently. He realizes that this is a life or death decision for him as much as it is for anybody else, and he goes about making the decision in the same way as anybody else. If you use analogies like this, you can help the person to see that decision-making on the basis of evidence is not bourgeois. Indeed, it has no political, economic, or social qualities connected with it whatever. It happens to be necessary to all human beings. It makes no difference what philosophy of life a person maintains. Makes absolutely no difference. He has to make decisions constantly on the basis of evidence, and all people do it in the very same way. The solipsist who says there is no world out there, nevertheless, looks around and evaluates evidence as to whether he's going to eat food or cardboard, and he ends up eating food rather than cardboard because of the same kind of decision-making on the basis of evidence that anybody else makes. You recall the story of the Christian Scientist who said that there was no evil and no pain, that this was all an illusion. The Christian Scientist made a real pain of herself by taking this viewpoint. And one day when she was bending over, a friend who had it with her stuck her with a hat pin, and she leapt into the air with a tremendous shriek. And when she had calmed down, she said, "I will admit this, the illusion of pain is as bad as I suppose the pain would have been." But of course, if you've got to predicate everything of the illusion that you would have to predicate of the reality, you have gained nothing by calling it an illusion. And that's exactly the situation with the type of person we're talking about here. The person says, "I don't have to worry about objectivity. It's a question of my bag." But in his ordinary life, in what he does, he acts as if the stuff out there were really there. He makes decisions in the very same way as anybody else. So this turns out to be nothing but verbalizing. The world is still there. The world is still objectively there. It doesn't make a particle of difference whether a person happens to consider himself hippie or military-industrial. The way of decision-making turns out to be the same. All right. If you can get the person to see that that is the situation, that he really does evaluate evidence daily, and that he has to make life-or-death decisions all the time, then you say to him, the very way in which you make those decisions, necessarily, when you hop on your Suzuki or when you eat your crusty old hamburger rather than eating a crusty old piece of cardboard, the very way you make decisions is all we're asking for relative to the gospel of Jesus Christ. And Christ has said that if you make the wrong decision relative to this, if you reject Christ, you are stacking up for yourself the worst conceivable life here and in eternity, and therefore it behooves you to do something about this. In other words, if you shift into a bit of law preachment in connection with the kind of operation we've just been discussing, you can very often get the guy to consider, at least, what Christianity has to offer. You see, the claims of Christ, as they're set forth in the primary documents, in the gospel records, are claims that are testable in exactly the same way as the question of crossing the street, the traffic question, or the question of what you choose to eat, or what vehicle you choose to jump upon. These are not questions off in a mystical realm, and it's important to show the person that that is the situation, that we are not asking of him anything other than what he has to do in his ordinary experience. Now, I admit that many of the people who have opted out in the fashion in which I have described the low-level tender-minded are not really interested in argument at all. They are not interested in evidence at all. It's a problem of interest more than anything else. And for that reason, if you find that that's the situation, if the person inconsistently says, okay, so the traffic is really there, but I still don't care a hang about Christianity, then at that point, where it's a matter of not caring a hang, having no desire to do anything with this, willfully refusing to face it, at that point, of course, you are not in an apologetic realm. At that point, you are in the realm of preachment. That's where the law needs to be brought down. And you need to preach the law with utmost severity so the person recognizes that, or at least is forced to listen to God's assertion that he is imperiling his immortal soul as long as he plays around with this kind of thing. One verse that I've used very effectively in situations like that is the verse where it says, and I mentioned this another time, that every knee shall bow and every tongue confess that Jesus Christ is Lord. Scripture makes plain that everybody, whether he likes it or not, is going to come to terms with Jesus Christ sooner or later. It's not a question of whether or not, it's just a question of when. And the issue is whether a man is going to come to terms with Christ now when he can do so to his eternal salvation, or whether he'll be forced to his knees to his eternal loss. And you shouldn't be afraid to use verses of this kind with people who show that they don't care enough to face the issues. Apologetics cannot create an interest in apologetics. Apologetics is not a field that produces motivation. What it does is to provide evidence. And if the problem is a motivational problem, then the only way to deal with this is in terms of the preaching that Scripture sets forth. But let's look at what I call the higher level tender-minded. And here we're in quite a different realm. Here I'm talking about the person who is aesthetically sensitive. The person whose concerns have always had to do with art and literature and personal satisfaction in a higher sense, and not primarily with issues of truth or falsity. You will think immediately of students you know who are in the field of literature, for example, or students in the fine arts, where there is a high degree of sensitivity and a concern for what is moving and real in the sense of touching man at his roots. Not a concern for truth over against one in a kind of objective, scientific, and technical sense. When you get into conversation with these people, you don't find that they are cavalier with regard to objectivity. It isn't that. It's that scientific or historical evidence just doesn't touch them where they live. It doesn't move them at the point of their deepest concerns. And so the question is there any way to do this? Is there any way to get at them at the point of their concern and yet not slip into a subjectivism which reduces Christianity to the level of religions that have no objective evidence? Some remarkable work has been done in this area in our own century, and this work has not taken place entirely within the framework of Christian scholarship. There have been avenues toward the sort of thing that I'm going to be talking about created by non-Christian scholars who have been working on other problems. And I'm going to begin with them, and then I'm going to move to the application of what they have developed to this particular issue. And the lines along which I'm moving this morning are presented in a great deal more detail in the book Myth, Allegory, and Gospel, which I've edited, and which contains essays by several scholars who work in this area. For example, Clyde Kilby, the most important American specialist on C.S. Lewis, a man who spent a summer with J.R.R. Tolkien before he died, and who knows his work intimately, and who did the essay on Tolkien in the book. All right, we're going to begin quite a ways from Christianity. We're going to begin with Carl Gustav Jung, J-U-N-G, Carl Gustav Jung. Jung represents one of the three main streams of psychoanalysis in the 20th century. Jung was a student and associate of good old Sigmund Freud back in Vienna in the early years of the century. But Jung broke with Freud, which is not terribly significant because virtually everybody broke with Freud. Freud was a very difficult person to live with. He obviously needed psychological help. If you think that that's an exaggeration, you ought to read Ernest Jones' two-volume standard biography of Freud. He had all kinds of strange hang-ups. He was a very rigid person, Freud, and his rigidity comes out in his psychoanalytic theory. Freud was as much of a materialist as Marx. Indeed, he was only a little bit broader than Feuerbach, whom I mentioned last time. For Freud, all psychological phenomena are attributable to materialistic factors. Just as for Marx, all historical events are attributable to materialistic factors. In his early years, Freud stressed a single principle called the libido, L-I-B-I-D-O, which is popularly regarded as the sex urge, but it's not quite that exciting. It really is the life urge. It's the urge toward life and positive expression, which comes from a physiological base. And Freud attempted to relate all human psychic activity back to that principle. Then later on in life, as Freud got older, he developed a second principle called the mortido, M-O-R-T-I-D-O, the mortido, or the death wish, as it's popularly called. And that is the urge to destruction, to self-destruction. It is the countervailing principle that operates in the opposite direction from the libido. Well, Jung found this suffocating. To try to handle all of man's psychic life in terms of materialistic factors and a limited number of principles was, in his opinion, a very unsophisticated and unrealistic way of taking care of the problem. Jung developed a much more all-embracing and fascinating system. And the essence of this system is that man's psychic life has certain basic symbols that comprise it. The symbols are not limited to one individual, nor are they limited to one culture. There is a universal body of symbols present in man's psychic life, and these symbols represent man's deepest needs. Jung called these symbols archetypes. Archetypes, archetypes. In other words, fundamental types. How did he discover this? He discovered it by his analytic sessions with his own contemporaries, but he also discovered it through a careful investigation of traditional literature, the kind of literature that bubbles up from the unconscious, that isn't consciously developed. Jung studied occult literature in a great deal of detail. I've gone into this a bit in my book, Principalities and Powers, on the world of the occult. I did a great deal of Jungian work in Strasbourg when I was doing my theological doctorate, because I worked on a man who was supposed to have been the founder of Rosicrucianism, a Lutheran theologian named Andrier, and I was able to show that Andrier very definitely did not bring about Rosicrucianism, and in fact opposed it. But it was necessary to get into a good deal of occult symbolism, and that brought me into the area of Jung's operations. Fact of the matter is that Jung, in investigating medieval alchemical manuscripts, for example, found that the same symbols appeared there in the drawings that Zurich businessmen talked about in their dream life. From the medieval alchemist to the modern Zurich businessman, the symbols remained basically the same. He found these same archetypal symbols appearing in Chinese astrological material, and so on. And he arrived at the conclusion that there is a fundamental and universal set of images or symbols that are fundamental to man's psychic life. He called these the archetypes of the collective unconscious. Archetypes of the collective unconscious, meaning that the unconscious is not individual only. There is such a thing as a collective unconscious. It's as if the psychic life of man interlocks, and one man's psychic life draws from a common pool in which everyone participates. What are some of these symbols? Well, there is the symbol of the old man, for example, generally pictured with a white beard and a long robe, a kind of Santa Claus figure, if you will. And Santa Claus turns out to be one of the reflections of that archetype. You know, Santa Claus is not limited to one particular tradition. No matter where you go, at least in the Indo-European world, you find Santa Claus appearing under different guises. Sometimes he is Père Noël, sometimes he is Saint Nicholas, and so on and so on and so on. In any case, this is a father image, if you will, a father symbol. He comes and he gives gifts to man. Then there is the old woman, the witch, if you will, the witch symbol, who introduces evil and misery, often as through trickery. There is the prince and the princess, the prince who so frequently saves the princess from some agony or difficulty. And so on and so on. We won't attempt to go into all of these, but one thing that we will note is that for Jung, there are particular archetypes that symbolize man's need of healing. Says Jung, if you look at man's psychic life, you find that man is fractured. There is a disjunction in man, and the object of man's psychic quest is to reconcile opposites, to bring wholeness back into his experience. Jung used the phrase the conjunction of opposites, the conjunction of opposites, the desire of people to heal the cleavage within their very being. There is a conviction that there is such a cleavage and it needs healing. There is a quest to bring wholeness to one's psychic life. And there are certain symbols that reflect that conjunction or that desire for conjunction. The most important of these is the symbol of the cross. And the symbol of the cross is not by any means limited to Christianity. I'm sure you realize this if you've studied any comparative religion. You know that the cross symbol is widely distributed, as is the snake symbol, often in conjunction with a cross. You know, when your local physician displays a caduceus, the symbol of medicine, the cross with a serpent entwined around it, that goes back to the hoary Greek antiquity. That was a medical symbol of healing. It didn't come, as you perhaps thought it did, from the Old Testament. There is no direct connection between those two. And yet in the Old Testament, it talks about Moses lifting up the serpent in the wilderness so that when people looked on the serpent, they would be healed. And in the case of the New Testament, we have Jesus in John 3 making a direct parallel between this and his own death for the sins of the world. As Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, so shall the Son of Man be lifted up, that whosoever believeth in him should not perish, but have everlasting life. The idea of the snake as a healing symbol and the cross as a healing symbol turns up in the unconscious life of man with remarkable regularity and is not to be explained by cultural borrowing, particularly. All right. Now let's take a look at another scholar of our time. This man is still alive, Mircea Eliade. First name M-I-R-C-E-A, last name E-L-I-A-D-E, Mircea Eliade. He is of Hungarian origin, but he went to France and spent a good part of his career in France. His early writings were done in the French language, and then about 15 years ago, he came to the United States, and he teaches at the University of Chicago. Most of his works that were done originally in French have been translated into English, so you can get at Eliade's stuff in English. His most famous work is The Myth of the Eternal Return, but there are any number of other books that he has done. He is the foremost living religious phenomenologist. You say, what could that conceivably be? Well, a religious phenomenologist is an in-depth religious sociologist. I suppose that's a bit redundant because no sociologist is ever in-depth, really. But it is conceivable, at least, that a person could penetrate below the statistical level to something of a bit more profundity. And Eliade has very definitely done this. Eliade is concerned with religious phenomena, but not simply on the statistical or descriptive level. What he tries to do is to get at the roots of religious phenomena. He tries to find out the fundamental informing ideas and concepts that result in religious practice. So, in other words, when he studies a primitive people, he doesn't just watch the Ubangis eating each other. He asks, what does it mean that they eat each other? In other words, he tries to cut to the fundamental notions at the root of their ideology. He is very much in the European tradition in that sense. You know, sociology in Europe has not been a statistical descriptive kind of thing, basically. It's been more of a philosophical and psychological sort of operation. Very few European psychologists or sociologists watch rats jumping across grids in a cage or human beings jumping across grids to their mates. That sort of activity that's carried on so often in American social sciences. They're more concerned with the root principles behind this kind of thing, and that's what Eliade is concerned with. All right, Eliade, in investigating primitive religions, has come very largely to the same conclusion that Jung came to by examining people's psychic life and by looking at occult literature. In other words, Eliade finds that there are fundamental root ideas that inform religious positions. And he talks also about the conjunction of opposites, that in religious phenomena, the effort is made to heal the disjunction within the self, and that this is done particularly through symbolic forms. And then finally, we have the area of folklore. And here I mention the name of Stith Thompson, S-T-I-T-H hyphen Thompson. That is a single last name. He is, of course, of English origin. You can tell that from the hyphen. You know that very sad case of Jeffrey. That was an instance where the rector stuttered when he was christened. So you come across phenomena of this kind from time to time. Stith Thompson was the head of the folklore department at the University of Indiana, and that was the center of folklore studies for a generation in the United States. Stith Thompson did the basic reference work in the field of folklore. This is called the Motif Index to Folk Literature. The Motif Index to Folk Literature. It's a multi-volume operation. It's still being continued. And what it does is to index motifs that appear in folk tales. Folk tales, you see, have a common series of motifs. You know this from your childhood. Folk tales involve, for example, elves and dwarfs and dragons and goblins and princes and princesses and old witches and kings, etc., etc. In other words, there is a common body of fundamental concepts appearing in folklore. And by indexing the folk tales of the world, Stith Thompson and his associates bring out the similarities among these tales. And here again, the same sort of thing comes up, namely that there is apparently a common symbolic body of psychic data. And isn't this what you would expect? Because, after all, folk tales bubble up from the unconscious, don't they? Just as primitive religion bubbles up from the unconscious. Primitive man didn't sit down and decide to write folk tales. In the case of Stith Thompson, then, and the work in folklore, you have the same sort of thing turning up that you do with Jung and Eliade. Folk tales don't arise by any sort of conscious invention. You don't, for example, have Father Ubangi talking to Son Ubangi and saying, "What do you want to be when you grow up, son?" And the son says, "I want to be the author of folklore." No, you don't have anything like that. People don't consciously choose to go into folklore as an occupation. Folk tales bubble up. One person tells a bit of a story, and then there's an expansion on it, and gradually these tales develop. And naturally, they reflect the fundamental needs and interests on a depth level of the people who are contributing to them. Now, the remarkable thing is that as you begin to analyze these common symbols, the archetypes, the imagery in folk tales, the concepts that appear in occult literature, as you begin to look at these, you discover that they are saying something remarkably familiar. I will tell you the story of Sleeping Beauty. In the story of Sleeping Beauty, a beautiful princess is subject to a prophecy, and the prophecy says that one day, generally on her 21st birthday, an old witch will get at her and will successfully give her something that will put her into a death-like sleep. The way in which this is done varies from story to story. Sometimes it is that the old witch will prick her with a needle. More often it's a matter of giving her something to eat, which she accepts, such as an apple, and as a result of eating this, she falls into a death-like sleep. Naturally, her father and mother do everything that they can, the king and queen do everything that they can to prevent this from occurring. But the whole business comes about just as indicated. And as she eats the fruit, she falls into a death-like trance, and when that takes place, everything in the castle stops. The servants who carry food stop in mid-passage, and the whole activity of the castle grinds to a halt. Nettles grow up, nettles and brambles grow up around the castle, and the whole business is cut off. It becomes a state of living death. However, there is another prophecy, and the prophecy is that someday a prince will come. And the prince does come, and in some of the stories, the brambles and the nettles just melt away before him as he enters the castle. In others, he's the only one who is able to cut these down and get into the castle. He gets into the castle, and there he sees the princess. And he gives her the kiss of love. And when he does, she is raised up. And at that very moment, the castle comes alive again. And this is followed by the marriage of the prince and the princess, and they live happily ever after. Haven't we possibly heard something like that somewhere before? Doesn't that have a strangely familiar ring to it? This, of course, is an approximation of the gospel story. It is indeed an analogy of the gospel story, and it is not accidental that it should be such. The princess is the human race, successfully tempted by the devil, the old witch. As a result of this, death falls upon not only the person who eats the fruit, but on the entire environment, the spillover effect, eh? The whole creation groaneth and travaileth. And no help is available from within the castle. The help has to come from outside the castle. And when the prince comes by prophecy, he is able to raise up the princess by love. And then comes the marriage supper of the Lamb, when Christ marries the church, and they live happily ever after in the kingdom. If you analyze folk tales, you discover that this kind of very close analogy occurs again and again and again. Why? Because there is a fundamental psychic life, a collective unconscious, expressing the same kind of fundamental needs. What this says is that inner life is not as individualistic as it often appears. Inner life actually is a participating sort of thing. When you ask for whom the bell tolls, it tolls for you. In other words, we have a situation in which the individual has needs that are far beyond his own. These needs spread across the board, and people participate in them wherever they are, and the folk tales are reflective of that sort of thing. If this is the situation, then there might be a way of testing it out. And the way to test it out could well be to attempt to produce modern folk tales that would have the same fundamental motifs in them. And if this were done sensitively, and particularly done by Christians who were concerned to get the gospel across on a deep level, people would respond to them on a level far deeper than that of rational cognition. In other words, these stories would hit people on a depth level which would be far greater than the ordinary. This is precisely what a school of Christian writers has done in our time. This school is usually called by the term the Inklings, I-N-K-L-I-N-G-S, and it focuses attention on two writers in particular, C.S. Lewis and J.R.R. Tolkien. Both of these men who are now dead were Christian, and they and their associates endeavored to do modern folk tales which would carry the same kind of impact as the traditional folk tale. If such tales have the impact that they hope that they do, then the result of this is a confirmation of the notion that there is a common psychic life, and that that common psychic life is pushing toward the Christian answer. Before I tell you a bit about the work of these men, let me tamp this down by a quotation from St. Augustine. At the beginning of the Confessions, St. Augustine presents a notion which is probably the most familiar notion in all of Augustine. Says he, you know, the Confessions are in the form of prayer. Says he, "Thou hast created us for thyself, O Lord. Thou hast made us for thyself, O Lord, and our hearts are restless until they rest in thee. Thou hast made us for thyself, O Lord, and our hearts are restless until they rest in thee." Meaning that the heart of every man can only be satisfied finally by the true God, the God who reveals himself in Jesus Christ. Another way of putting that is to think of man's heart as a picture puzzle. A picture puzzle with one piece missing. Now, of course, as you examine people's hearts, not having that piece there in the picture, you can't determine what it is in a strict sense. But if all the other pieces are there and you put those pieces together, you can get the shape of the missing piece simply from the other pieces that are around. And what Augustine is saying is that if a person puts together the pieces of his inner life, and he does this sensitively and properly, the missing piece will have the shape of a cross. There is only one piece that will finally put the puzzle together properly, and that piece will be cross-shaped. And that is precisely what derives from the kind of work that we have been discussing. That is the derivation from the kind of work that Jung and Eliade and Stith Thompson have carried out, that all people are in need of the same thing. They want to get the opposites in their personality brought together. And the way to get them together is by way of the cross. And people intuit this, even though they have not been in contact with the historic Christian faith. It therefore follows that if we are able to confirm that that kind of operation goes on, then when you are dealing with the higher level tender-minded, you can offer such literature to the higher level tender-minded, and you can expect that in reading such literature, the person will recognize his psychic needs and recognize that the answer to these needs is only finally provided by the gospel, to which his inner life and the literature he reads points as analogy. C.S. Lewis did a series of 7 books for children called the Narnian Chronicles. These are set in a mythical land, and the characters and images of traditional folklore are employed. The gospel story is woven through the Narnian books. I've discussed these in detail in an essay that appears in Myth, Allegory, and Gospel, and my first correspondence with Lewis before his death came when I sent him that article, and we got to discussing this kind of thing. And the essay emphasizes that the Narnian Chronicles are actually modern folk tales which provide a sort of test as to this theory. And children who read the Narnian Chronicles, sensitive children who read them, are moved on a level far deeper than the level of straight rationality. They appreciate the stories for their excitement and for their external characteristics. But there is something about these stories that hit at the deepest level. Indeed, you find that a sensitive child reacts even more profoundly to this sort of thing than the child does to a traditional folk tale. You know, a really sensitive child, when a tale like Sleeping Beauty is first told to the child, will actually weep at the turn in the fairy story, at the point where the prince kisses the princess and all comes out right. And the child will say, if only it were real, if only it really happened. What this is an expression of is the desperate desire of the human heart to have this kind of thing take place in reality. J.R.R. Tolkien did something even more profound. Perhaps his work is the most important single literary work of our century. It may well be that The Lord of the Rings, the three-volume trilogy, will eventually have a place in world literature similar to Dante's in Divine Comedy or Milton. It is that kind of magnificent, sweeping work done with incredible genius. The Lord of the Rings is a three-volume mythical novel, and this mythical novel employs folklore motifs. And when adults read it, they are grabbed by it. They don't know exactly why, but the thing becomes more real to them than their ordinary experience. When The Lord of the Rings first came out in paperback, students were just thrown by this kind of thing. They were more interested in Middle Earth, in the realm created in The Lord of the Rings, than in their ordinary experience. Posters cropped up everywhere. Come to Middle Earth. Tolkien societies arose. At the time of a national election, there were buttons that appeared all over the place, and the buttons used the imagery of The Lord of the Rings. Very significantly, this was a national election, and you could get a button which said, elect your local hobbit. The hobbits being the leading characters in the Lord of the Rings. Or vote for Gandalf. Gandalf for president. Gandalf is the father figure of the Lord of the Rings, the God the Father, the Old Testament prophet figure. What is that sort of thing saying? It's saying that the only way really to take care of our problems is somehow to have this become real. You know, instead of having to put up with some greasy politician in Washington, if only we could have a Gandalf. See, here is Plato's longing for the philosopher king being extended to the deepest levels. Why does this stuff get at people the way it does? It gets at people because it reflects their deepest needs and because it's an analogy and pointer to the gospel. It is a pre-evangelism, a proto-evangelion. It points on to the gospel of Christ. And Tolkien has expressed this specifically in an essay on fairy stories, which is the theoretical foundation for all of this. And I'm going to read the pertinent paragraph from Tolkien's essay, and you'll see exactly what is going on here. This is what Tolkien says. The Gospels contain a story of a larger kind which embraces all the essence of fairy stories. They contain many marvels, peculiarly artistic, beautiful, and moving, mythical, in quotes, in their perfect, self-contained significance, and at the same time powerfully symbolic and allegorical. And among the marvels is the greatest and most complete conceivable eucatastrophe, that is, a decisive event which is perfectly good, from the Greek eu meaning good and catastrophe, decisive event. Think of utopia. No place where everything is good. Says Tolkien, among the marvels in the gospel stories is the greatest and most complete conceivable eucatastrophe. The birth of Christ is the eucatastrophe of man's history. The resurrection is the eucatastrophe of the story of the incarnation. This story begins and ends in joy. That is a technical term in these writers. Joy means an event that we would want repeated forever, or an experience we would want repeated forever, is contrasted with happiness. C.S. Lewis did his spiritual autobiography under the title Surprised by Joy. The story begins and ends in joy. It has preeminently the inner consistency of reality. There is no tale ever told that men would rather find was true, and none which so many skeptical men have accepted as true on its own merits. For the art of it has the supremely convincing tone of primary art, that is, of creation. To reject it leads either to sadness or to wrath. You see, if a person finally does hit a story which meets him at the deepest level of human need, to reject that will lead inevitably to sadness or to wrath. Look at the effect of Jesus on his contemporaries. It's exactly that. People who didn't accept Jesus either crucified him in wrath, or, like the rich young ruler, they went away sorrowful, knowing that they had rejected the one thing that would give them life. All right, Tolkien continues. It is not difficult to imagine the peculiar excitement and joy that one would feel if any specially beautiful fairy story were found to be primarily true, its narrative to be history, without thereby losing the mythical or allegorical significance that it had possessed. The joy would have exactly the same quality, if not the same degree, as the joy which the turn in a fairy story gives. Such has the very taste of primary truth. It looks forward or backward, the direction in this regard is unimportant, to the great eucatastrophe. Just as the Old Testament prophets look ahead and we look back, the direction makes no difference. Whether these are fairy tales of early times or modern literary fairy tales makes no difference. They look forward or backward to the great eucatastrophe. The Christian joy, the Gloria, is of the same kind, but it is preeminently, infinitely, if our capacity were not finite, high and joyous. Because this story is supreme, and it is true. Art has been verified. God is the Lord of angels and of men and of elves. Legend and history have met and fused. See, Tolkien is saying here that what we want is to have fairy tales come true. In the case of the gospel story, you have the summation of all of the characteristics of the very best fairy stories. But this is true. It did really happen. It isn't once upon a time. It's in the days of Caesar Augustus, when Serenius was governor of Syria. It happened in objective and real history. Here we have the fairy tale par excellence, the greatest of all fairy tales, that turns out to have really occurred. And thus all of the fairy tales of the world point to it and find their fulfillment in it. God is the Lord of angels and of men and of elves. Legend and history have met and fused. Art has been verified. Now you see, the higher level, tender-minded person wants art to be verified. His interest is in art, but he's not interested only in subjective feelings. He's interested in coming to terms with what is the deepest and most significant artistic truth. What we can do, therefore, for him is to put into his hands the Narnian Chronicles, the Lord of the Rings, and other literature of this sort. And as he reads these, he is drawn to the express fulfillment of this kind of thing in the gospel story. You see, we are dealing here with the inner life of man. We are dealing with exactly the area of need that the tender-minded person has, but we are not dealing in terms of some sort of individualistic subjectivism, because this is a way of showing that there is an objective answer in the psychic life, that psychic life does have an objective kind of substance to it, and that it isn't possible just to accept any old subjective answer. The subjective answer has got to accord with the needs that bubble up universally. And those needs are the ones that coordinate precisely with the gospel story. This is a way, in other words, of introducing objectivity into the realm of the subjective. a way of getting at the objective and common needs of people which the gospel story can fulfill. Now you say, but my goodness, couldn't the person say, it's just a better fairy tale than any of the rest? Look at the people who have claimed that the gospel story was a fairy tale, a myth in that sense of the word. Couldn't a person get out from under it that way? Well, yes, a person could present that kind of an objection. But as you can see, the minute a person poses that objection, he is moved out of the tender-minded category back into the tough-minded. And you've already got an answer for that. Namely, that the documents are solid historical documents and these events really occurred as objective fact. So that the gospel story becomes verified on two levels. It's verified on the objective level of history. It's also verified on the subjective level of common psychic need. All right. We will now open things up to questions relative to this sort of thing and also to other questions that you may not have had a chance to answer, to ask last night. And then, after we have spent about 15 minutes roughly on questions, we will take a wee break, and we will come back from that break to go over some of the literature of the field. Yes?
Didn't Tolkien deny that there was any allegorical content to the Lord of the Rings?
Correct, he did. And here you have to be able to distinguish between allegory and myth. He never said it wasn't mythical. He said it wasn't allegorical. Now, allegory is the sort of thing that goes on in Pilgrim's Progress, where you can create an equivalence between a character or a scene and an idea. And that's made very easy in Pilgrim's Progress because the names attributed to the various people and events, Christian, you know, and so forth. That's a one-to-one type of relationship, and it is quite cerebral. That is to say, allegory is more of an emotive thing than straight writing, but not much more so. When you read allegory, you engage in an intellectual identification of the various elements in the story, and you get a bit more impact than you would if it were done as nonfiction, but it doesn't strike too very deeply. Myth is something far more than that. In myth, the characters involved and the scenes are taken from the archetypal realm. They are fundamental in the sense of the sort of thing that is bubbled up in primitive religious experience, in psychic life, in the occult, in folklore. Those are the elements that enter into the picture, and the events of the story follow patterns that have already been established. And so when you read that type of material, often you can't say that this equals that in any one-to-one sense. But you feel as if this stuff has hit you at the very center of your being. It is somehow working on you on a subliminal level that goes far below that of cognition. And that's what's going on in The Lord of the Rings. You can't say, for example, that Tom Bombadil equals X, or that Frodo equals Y. In some instances, these characters have a pretty clear referent, but in other instances, they don't. The characters transcend any simple equivalence, even as human beings have a tendency to transcend simple equivalences. And Tolkien is just trying to get you not to treat The Lord of the Rings as you would Pilgrim's Progress. Yes, in case I didn't repeat that question, I may have gone right into it without repeating it. The question was, didn't Tolkien specifically state that he was not doing allegory in The Lord of the Rings? Yes. Yes. The question, didn't I say in the first lecture, or in one of the lectures, that When Orthodox Jews heard Jesus refer to himself as the Son of Man, they immediately realized that he was attributing deity to himself. Why is that? Well, the reason is that the expression Son of Man didn't originate with Jesus. It originated in the Old Testament. If you look in Daniel 7:13 and in Ezekiel, you will find that the expression Son of Man is introduced there to refer to the apocalyptic Messiah. Messiah coming at the end of time to complete history. That's where the passage comes from that Jesus quoted before the high priest. You have said correctly that I am the Messiah, and you will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with all the heavenly host. So the minute that an Orthodox Jew heard that expression, Son of Man, he immediately thought of the Old Testament origin of the expression. It, in other words, had a determined meaning before Jesus came on the scene, and that determined meaning comes directly from the Old Testament prophets. The question, do the Jews realize that Messiah was going to be deity? Well, in Jewish messianic speculation, there are various possibilities. Today, if you talk with a Jewish person about this, he will say that, after all, Israel collectively can be regarded as a kind of Messiah. And Messiah could very well have been a person, a human being, elevated to this kind of stature, that sort of thing. Those are, of course, possibilities. But the prevailing emphasis in Jesus' time was most definitely on the Messiah as a God representative, so thoroughly identified with God that there was no real point in making a distinction. This was really a theophany of God carrying out and fulfilling his purposes. And the evidence of this is the fact that because Jesus asserted that he was the Son of Man, he was charged with blasphemy. You see? He hardly would have been charged with blasphemy if the use of that phrase had not been connected with deity. Okay? What else? Yes. The question is, would Stith Thompson and other folklore people do this kind of operation with reference to the Old Testament? How would they treat biblical material? The answer is that as folklorists, they feed the Old Testament stuff right into the same operation as they do other literature. They do not deal with questions of historicity. And so you'll find that the birth narratives of Jesus, the virgin birth, and various events of his life will appear in the motif index along with other traditional material. They don't feel that it's their function to answer the historical questions relative to these materials. They are interested in the materials as literary materials. And I don't think that that's illegitimate. Of course, that drives some extreme fundamentalists wild, because they assume that if there are parallels between folk literature and the Bible, then that's running down the Bible. But that again follows from the separationism of the fundamentalists. Fundamentalists want to separate what's going on in Christianity completely from other things. They don't like parallels because the parallels seem to knock down the walls and create bridges. You see? What they forget is that it's far more important to have bridges coming into the faith so that non-Christians can come in readily than it is to have walls to protect them. And all of what we've been talking about this morning is the kind of bridge that God has created by common grace. You see, these are manifestations of common grace. God has, this is the sort of thing that Romans refers to when it says that the truth of God is written on men's hearts. All of what I've been saying here could be regarded as a sort of commentary on those verses. People know in their heart of hearts that they need something and that the only fulfillment of this would be an answer along the lines of the Christian faith. They don't know the details of it, but they know that other things don't satisfy. And that's why as you put each piece into the puzzle of the human heart, finally the shape of the answer appears, even though you don't have the answer itself. Let me give you another example. This from the area of philosophy. Plato, who is regarded as the grand old man of all philosophy, Whitehead said all of Western philosophy is a footnote to Plato. Plato says in the Phaedo, P-H-A-E-D-O, Plato says in the Phaedo, I have done the best I can. If only I had a raft of revelation to carry me over the seas of doubt. Now that's a recognition on the part of Plato that human speculation and human reasoning relative to the problems he dealt with can only go so far. And he recognized that he would need a revelation, something from the outside, in order to get the kind of perspective that was really necessary. That's an example of how the sensitive thinker discovers that the shape of his need is of a certain sort. And then along comes the Christian faith and exactly fits that missing place. Yes?
It seems to me that...
This is a very good reference. The reference is to a place where C.S. Lewis mentions Bultmann and says that Bultmann doesn't understand either myth or gospel. I don't know exactly the reference there, but I imagine it probably turns up in Christian Reflections, in the posthumous volume in which Lewis's excellent essay on biblical criticism is published. Lewis is quite right. Bultmann says that in order to get at the heart of the Christian message, you must demythologize it. You must remove the mythical elements. And these mythical elements, he says, are part of the New Testament or biblical worldview. People in those days thought in terms of virgin births and resurrections and miracles and that kind of thing. Of course, that is foreign to the modern man, and therefore to have the gospel move people today, you're going to have to get rid of that sort of thing and penetrate to the real heart of it. And what is the real heart of it? Well, for Bultmann, it is existential experience, self-authentication, as he puts it. Where does he get this? He gets it from Heidegger. The existentialist philosopher Heidegger was with Bultmann at the University of Marburg in 1926, and they attended each other's lectures, and Bultmann was deeply influenced by Heidegger. So, says Bultmann, what you need to do is to get rid of this peripheral stuff, and then you can find the real heart of this, which is Heideggerian existential experience. Now, the fact of the matter is that all that Bultmann has done here is to substitute a modern philosophical idea, namely self-authentication, for the very heart of the gospel. He, by removing the quote-unquote mythology, he removes the only thing that is universal from it. You see, it's actually the mythology that is the very heart of it. The mythology, in quotes, happens to be the depth element in the whole thing, not self-authentication. And once you have pulled those things away, you have not pulled away simply a first-century ideology. You've pulled away all that makes this genuinely universal. So when you end up demythologizing, you end up automatically losing the gospel and preventing the Christian message from having any effect on anybody who doesn't happen to be a Heideggerian. And of course, at the same time, and this is the point that's usually raised by evangelical theologians, at the same time, by removing the quote-unquote myth, you remove the history, because this myth is, as a matter of fact, history. And once you've taken away the resurrection, for example, you've taken away the only objective proof that you have that the whole business is correct. So in one fell swoop, you have taken away the subjective impact of it and any objective verification of it. What Bultmann does is to engage in a total annihilation of the Christian faith. With friends like that, you don't need any enemies. People like that are far more harmful to the Christian faith than people like Bertrand Russell, for example, who stand outside and state exactly that they are against Christianity, and then you can at least have confrontations. But in the case of people like Bultmann, because they are teaching in in theological chairs, and they are in Europe, you will always have simple-minded, lame-brained Protestant liberals who will accept what they have to say and promote it, because America is the elephant's graveyard of old German heresies. That's where old German heresies come to die.